is CBSi on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Scholar Report with CEO Chris Riegel of Scholar.com, a global technology firm transforming the retail space with digital signage, a global firm. We begin in China. The visit by the Secretary of State, the first by a secretary in 5 years, led to incomplete headlines, but the suggestion that the thaw is not ready or the patch is not working or the diplomacy, which the secretary, Mr. Blinken, characterized as positive immediately afterwards, has fallen short, perhaps because of the unfortunate remark that was quoted by President Biden, calling or naming Xi Jinping a dictator. He's the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. And perhaps because China is more aggressive than diplomatic itself. You will recall that for some weeks and months, Mr. Riegel has been reporting to you what he knows of the business on the mainland. We have a Financial Times essay most recently looking to the Chinese economy to revive, and it is not. Looking to the Chinese economy to use the tools that it used in 2008, 2009 to ride out the Great Recession. And it is not. Not yet, anyway. Chris, a very good evening to you. The choices in 2008, 2009 was a massive stimulus program. As I recall, it was something like $4 trillion. It was big. And China survived the Great Recession quite differently than we did here in the United States and Europe, where the slow growth continued for years. However, this time, China has not used its ability to lower rates dramatically. The People's Bank of China has lowered them marginally, a smidge, nothing large. And so, therefore, they're not flooding the economy with credit, and that leaves the debtors in a quandary and everyone hesitant. Your measure of the Chinese economy, does it have a plan that you can see being created or that is possible in the immediate future? Because the reports from Europe are gloomy. Good evening to you, Chris.
Good evening, John. In watching Chinese press and the specific sites that the government uses to position, you've seen a change in position from the Chinese perspective of trying to re-engage the West more aggressively. So under One Belt, One Road, you had the China above all kind of approach. Now you're seeing, especially recently, more and more discussion in People's Daily and other propaganda mouthpieces of the regime stating how important it is for China and the U.S. to work together, to work to economic benefit, et cetera. That would likely signal that there is more financial pressure in China on reduced manufacturing and the need for Chinese to not pick fights with their customers. So I believe that the signals that are being sent are, hey, we're open for business. We need more orders to keep things going. And we're going to take a little bit more open-handed approach towards the rest of the world.
The premier in China, the man who is charged with money, has said that China needs investment and China needs trade. Yes, I agree. The puzzle is, does Xi Jinping's government want investment and trade? Certainly, investors have been warned that their money is at risk and that the Chinese economy is prey to intervention by Beijing. And as for trade, the tariffs that exist are there to move China away from its confrontational style and towards international integration. Do you see any change in China's posture towards trade or investment? Investors being treated well, or trade being fair-minded and not about the previous instances of intellectual property theft or just plain dumping?
So, John, it's somewhat fascinating. In Mr. Xi's last speech in December, January to the party, he, in the speech, mentioned that it was important for Chinese to be successful, but not too successful. If you are too successful, you are corrupt in some fashion. We'll figure out the details later, but if you hit it really big, you had to have done something wrong. That was a really interesting signal. And one of the big challenges with Chinese liquidity is you have wealthy Chinese removing plus or minus about $200 billion a month from the Chinese economy, where they're taking it overseas. Because as soon as Mr. Xi signaled great success equals corruption, those that do have substantial success in China needed to find a fallback position. Where could they move their money out of China? So there's this great sucking sound of money coming out of China. In parallel to that, Mr. Xi is then trying to reach out to European companies, American companies, saying, hey, we want your capital to come into China. So this capital crunch is hoisted on their own petard of accusing successful people in China of being corrupt and a lot of that native wealth leaving China.
To California, Silicon Valley, the growth of these last years led by some of the, if not the most well-to-do people in the solar system. Right now, there are articles routinely in the Wall Street Journal and Barron's and Financial Times about empty offices in Silicon Valley. Heretofore, it's been okay to explain that about work from home. But the large companies, I'm thinking of Google, no longer tolerate work from home. Those office buildings, those office spaces look to be empty because businesses have gone away. Is that an accurate portrait, Chris? Are we looking at the commercial real estate market of center cities now spreading to Silicon Valley?
You're certainly seeing the impact in Silicon Valley of that work from home trend. In many of the tech companies in the beginning of the pandemic were extremely liberal about work from home. Now that they're ordering people back, people are saying, hey, maybe I don't want to work here anymore. So you see some workforce shrinkage. Additionally, you have a lot of headwinds in the Valley because of the Silicon Valley Bank failure and the general constriction in the US economy. Private equity and venture capitalists have dialed back quite a bit. So you don't have the demand engine that would consume much of that space. But it's certainly safe to say in many of the major population centers in the big downtowns across the U.S. that there is more and more open space and not likely to see, even with a return to the office, that space being consumed fully.
San Francisco, we've spoken at great length about the troubles there. The doom loop metaphor that was used by the Financial Times that is now routine. And that's important to me because I see that doom loop metaphor being used in other cities. Los Angeles is overwhelmed with the homeless right now. San Diego is experiencing the homeless challenge one more time. In New York City, the mayor is burdened not only by homeless, but also by the surge of migrants. So the doom loop is useful across America when cities describe their difficulties. Again, is this work from home? The pandemic's over. Is this the commercial real estate market that is either overpriced or underutilized at this point? Can you tell as the model in San Francisco seems to be spreading?
It's probably three things. Number one is crime and safety. So people not wanting to come back to work or not going back to work in the major cities because they don't feel safe, loss in tourism. You've seen that very specifically in San Francisco. Second is the work from home and that economic drain. The third is in many of these cities that were simply overbuilt or built for early 2000s economies. Now that economy continues to change or to evolve. You have challenges with, as interest rates have risen, many developments, many industries, many businesses in those center cities, as the interest rates have gone up, may no longer be viable to support the loans on these hotels, on these large office buildings. So you'll see a lot of givebacks there that are caused by that increased interest rate and companies not being able to survive in the current economic climate.
The commercial real estate, you've identified it over the last months as a problem that's in the near future and that is not solved by the banks. The write-downs have started. Is that adequate, Chris, to write them down or to turn the keys over? Is that going to solve the wave that's coming?
It will not. That extend and pretend will work in the short term, but you're still looking at somewhere between 1.7 and 2 trillion of commercial debt that has to be refinanced, in many cases cannot be refinanced. That's a two-pronged problem. One, you'll have large-scale defaults and large-scale turnbacks, which will bring down a number of the regional banks that are most heavily exposed to that and cause risk there. Two, new developments and new developers are stopped on projects because they cannot get financing to keep projects moving. So it will have an impact on the creation of new office buildings, housing units, et cetera, because of that constriction in the credit market.
Is this true not only in the legacy cities, the industrial north? Is it also true in the New South or Florida or Texas? Are those cities also burdened with commercial real estate mortgages?
You see the same challenges in the commercial real estate market in markets like Houston and markets like Atlanta, not to the same density of problem that you'd have in New York or San Francisco, but the same trend is there on highly leveraged properties. Anytime that interest rates go up three, four, five times becomes a problem for those developers. So within it, same problem, but at a different scale, it is starting to take roost in markets like Houston as well.
Chris Riegel is the CEO of Scala.com, a global technology firm transforming the retail space with digital signage. This is the Scala Report. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.